This is GeekSpeak for Saturday, December 12th, 2015. You're listening to Independent Public Radio 88.9 KOSP Santa Cruz and streaming live worldwide at KOSP.org. It's time now for GeekSpeak. Welcome to GeekSpeak, bridging the gaps between geeks and the rest of humanity. Please keep in mind the views expressed during GeekSpeak are not necessarily those of KOSP or any of the Geeks' affiliated organizations. I'm Lyle Troxell, and with me in the studio is Mr. Ben Jaffe. The unemployed still, yes?
I am unemployed until the end of the year. By the way, you sound really nice today.
I have a cold.
Oh, I'm sorry.
My deep.
Actually, yeah, you are listening to two people, one who just recently had a cold and one who has a cold now.
Mm. Ben, last week you mentioned XKCD, specifically the webcomic, and talked about an example, but really about a book that's coming out from the same author.
Yes.
Who is this man?
So Randall Munroe puts out a comic called XKCD. You probably have heard us talk about it at length several times.
Last week we talked about it quite a bit, but you got the book.
I got the book.
You brought it in.
It was the first book I think that I've ever pre-ordered. And I'm very lucky. I happened to find out about it, and I pre-ordered it 2 days before it came out, so I didn't have to wait very long.
That's awesome. It's called Thing Explainer.
It's called Thing Explainer. It explains complicated stuff in simple words. It uses only the most commonly used 1,000 words in the English language.
You mean 1,000?
1,000, right. But so, the word 1,000 is not one of the top 1,000 words. So
when you say most common, like if you take all of English, if you will, contemporary English, and you look at the repetitive qualities of words, and then you take only the top 1,000 words. That's all you use. Can you
Just to be clear, that does raise a question, which I had when I ordered the book. How the heck do you choose the top 1,000, the top 1,000 words? I keep saying this now. Because, you know, if you're looking at a corpus of literature versus technical papers versus this versus that versus the internet versus Wikipedia, I mean, like, it really depends on what you count. And so he actually has a whole set. He has four paragraphs talking about how he decided to count the words. He said you can look at what words people use in TV shows or books or movie stories or news stories or in the letters that they write or when they're sending computer messages. So he went through and he kind of like used a bunch of different means, but he kind of hand-selected words.
Mm-hmm.
Well, he did in a relatively fair way, Bill.
Why is this a useful way to explain things? Why is it a useful way to simplify the vocabulary to 1,000 words?
Right. So you're a computer programmer.
I am a
programmer. I'm a computer programmer. If I say classical
inheritance,
you know what I'm talking about. And with that term comes a whole bunch of context, right?
Yes.
Especially if we're talking about JavaScript, then you might be like, oh, well, you know, you may not want to use classical. You might want to use prototypical inheritance and all that stuff. And if we keep talking like this, we lose half of our or more of our listeners. And the reason is that we're using jargon.
Yeah.
Now, this jargon makes it really easy for us to communicate very quickly about technical topics, but it also can be alienating to beginners.
Okay. But at the same time, a rich vocabulary allows you to converse at a higher level.
Absolutely.
And without that vocabulary, you cannot get to the level of fluency that you need in a topic domain. So it's important that if you say jargon, I'll use the term jargon, is used in a discipline, because without that, you're just not able to explore the same kind of mentality. You can't think about things at a complex level without the words to think about them.
To some extent, I actually do agree with you, but there are a surprising number of things that he explains in this book.
Well, this is the important thing, is that this is for explaining for people that are not experts in the
area.
So he doesn't use any of that jargon,
uses
the simple thing. It's perfect for basic introductions. Can you give us a reading, a little bit of one?
Yeah. I'd like to read an example of this being a good thing and this being a bad thing.
Okay.
So, for example, if you look at so first of all, it's just really funny, right? So, if you look at the headlines for each of these different things, he explains under a car's front cover.
Wait.
Pretty
what?
Simple.
Under a car's front cover.
Okay. Under the hood, right?
Right.
There's also skyboat with turning wings. What's that?
That's a helicopter.
It's a skyboat. It's an airplane thing. It's a vehicle with turning wings.
And turning wings, that's what made me think of it as a helicopter.
Right.
Right.
Now, if you look at something like the wing controller, this is what he says for the wing controller. And this whole thing is beautifully, beautifully illustrated.
Sure.
It says, this is a machine for making small changes to how the wings are turned as they swing around, which changes how they push on the air. It's a little confusing. You can read more about how it works below. And he goes into even more detail, right?
Right, great.
So that's a great example.
The pitch control of each blade. Because right. As you rotate the blades towards one direction, the craft actually travels that direction. That's how you move a helicopter
right,
back and forth.
But when
really
you
cool.
say pitch control,
oh, right, of course,
my brain turns off a little bit because I don't use those words very often.
You use pitch control.
No. Well, I do, but you get the idea.
Yes.
Here's an example of where it's just ridiculous. Some okay. things are very, very difficult to explain using the top 1,000
Is this
words.
Under the car cover?
This is the same page. This page actually folds out. So it's a, what do you call that? Like it's like the magazines that fold out the
sure.
pages.
And a centerfold. Big.
That's it. Yeah. This is called Firebox, also known as the engine, right?
But engine's not one of the top 1,000 words, nope. So you have to describe it simpler.
Firebox. I'm just going to read this whole thing.
Okay, all right? Go for it.
This firebox is the car's pusher. Like skyboat pushers, it makes power by burning fire water using air from outside. To get pushing power from the fire water, the car burns it in little closed boxes. When the water burns, it gets hot, which makes it bigger and pushes on the walls of the box. One of the walls on the box can move, and it has a stick that joins it to a wheel. When the sides of the little boxes move, their sticks move the wheels, push the wheels around. Those wheels are all joined by a turning stick. That stick turns more wheels, and those wheels turn the wheels that touch the ground.
Wow.
So, like, me reading that, my brain turned off a little bit because there just aren't quite enough words. I mean,
well,
like,
the thing is, as you described that there was a hole in the box and that there was a stick connected to the hole, I immediately went, oh, that's the cylinder, and then that's pushing on another wheel. Oh, that must be pushing on the crankshaft. Like, I was translating as we went so that I
and
could have
why
the
you
vocabulary
could understand
to understand
it.
What you were saying. Because
yeah.
if not, it was a lot of the same words.
It's a lot of the same words,
wheels
yeah.
pushes wheels pushes wheels.
But anyway,
Beautiful. Beautiful descriptions, though.
I normally do not recommend that people buy things. I love this book.
Do you love it because you love the idea of explaining things simply? What is it about?
It's a combination of the comedy of explaining complicated things using simple words and how that can be funny, and also the brilliance of taking some of this stuff outside of the realm of, let's say, academia, like a particle accelerator, right? Usually people don't need to understand how particle accelerators work unless they're working at prestigious universities that have them or studying it. It's really cool to see some of this stuff being brought to a level where even if you're a complete layman in the area, you can understand it. There's another page on the sun, and it talks about the different temperatures and why things are the way they are. And then there's a little area that says something to the effect of this air is a little hotter than the air below it. We don't quite understand why.
Fantastic.
Now, you wouldn't find an explanation like that. You know, this is how things are. We don't know why. You would have to dig through to figure out that there is no explanation
sure.
for it. You wouldn't be told, oh, we don't understand this yet as
right.
readily.
The book is Thing Explainer, Complicated Stuff in Simple Words. It's available by Houghton Mifflin Harcourt, and the author is Randall Monroe, who you've heard of as the author of XKCD many times here on GeekSpeak. You can buy this book through many retailers, of course, and please
and
do so
you
if you're interested.
You can figure that out.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, it's the kind of book that would look good on a coffee table.
Ben, I have a admission. I'd like to admit something.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, and that is that I don't exactly know what a Tamagotchi is.
A Tamagotchi?
I believe at one point in my life in the late mid-90s or so, people had little electronic toys on their keychain.
All right,
and
I'm
these
about
things
to
were
show you.
Pseudo-alive. Yes, that's the thing. Okay,
the thing.
I did know what it was. It looked like a little key fob with a screen on it, and if you didn't interact with this key fob, this pseudo-alive thing, it would actually die.
Yeah, it acted kind of like
wanted,
a pet.
Yeah, it wanted to be fed, things like that. And you had to click on it, and I never understood it, but some people really were addicted to these
right,
things.
Yeah. It's the idea of you carry around this little pet in your pocket, and you have to tend to it and make sure. It's kind of like the pet rock, but a little bit less rock-like, a little bit more interactive, right? Rocks don't have screens. They don't get hungry, nor do they emulate hunger.
Almost completely unlike a rock.
Right, exactly. But for some reason, actually, I don't understand why people had pet rocks. Do you?
I think that the mammalian, how do you say?
Mammalian,
yeah. The mammalian quality of nurturing the young is embedded in us quite well, and we can
put that upon anything. It's a rock.
Yeah, but we can put that emotion upon anything. It's so ingrained in us. If it looks kind of cute, there you go. So you put eyeballs on a rock, and it looks kind of cute, and all of a sudden you can treat it as a pet.
Including perhaps a Tamagotchi?
The Tamagotchi, sure. Similar thing.
You can anthropomorphize it.
Yeah.
So I have a great story about this, and this actually comes back to XKCD. So XKCD made a comic. Randall Monroe made a comic quite a while ago, and it has a little picture of a bunch of Tamagotchis all kind of – it's almost like they're hanging on like electronic tree branches or something. They're all connected, kind of matrix-like.
So keychains with little screens hanging on a tree of wires of some sort. Okay.
And the text says, "My hobby, running a massive – distributed computing project that simulates trillions and trillions of Tamagotchis and keeps them all constantly fed and happy."
Okay, sure. Why wouldn't you draw a comic like that?
Yeah. Right. Yeah. So
the idea being that this is a simulated living creature, you interact with it and you have to feed it by engaging in the small program that's on this thing so that it stays alive. But it's feeding off your idea of taking care of things, and it's kind of an interesting problem.
Yeah,
so
you can't
Randall
just set
says
it
in
and
his comic,
it.
Basically, how about I write a distributed system that actually does that for me?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah,
it's creating a whole universe.
It's like the idea behind the automatic cat food dispenser, where
if you had a robotic cat.
If only I wait, what?
Well, that's the pattern of it, right? You have something that takes care of something that doesn't really need to be taken care of.
Oh yeah, that's true. Yeah. That's true. It's kind of a silly idea of like the Tamagotchi exists to be nurtured, and so if you create something where you don't have to nurture it, you're kind of defeating the purpose of it existing. So the reason I bring this up is that a hardware hacker actually created this.
I'm assuming not trillions of Tamagotchi, but just a small amount.
Yeah, so he actually built an infinite network of virtual Tamagotchi. Infinite presumably could mean that it could be as infinite as you wanted if you had the hardware, the computing power. Now, my question is, where do you get that many Tamagotchi?
eBay.
You could. Then you have to, build an interface to push all the buttons and stuff. What he actually did is he implemented the original hardware as a virtual machine.
Beautiful. I was wondering, it's like, because that's a lot of hardware, and then you have all these wires, and you get these little devices.
Yeah.
So he just simulates the original program, or simulates the original hardware, runs the original program on the simulated hardware, then creates a virtual world that feeds and nourishes these things.
Right. It's very Matrix-like.
Except for non-self-aware creatures. Not nearly as creepy as Matrix.
Yeah, that's true.
Do you recall Ship in a Bottle? When I say Ship in a Bottle, does that remind you of anything?
Are you talking about the Star Trek episode?
Episode 138.
Oh my God, I'm so glad.
Oh,
because
this totally reminds me. This is a Next Generation episode where, with an argument between Geordi and Data, they accidentally create Moriarty, Professor James Moriarty, who cannot just defeat Holmes, but who can defeat Data because of the phrasing of Geordi's phrasing.
He is a virtual person. He's a hologram.
Yeah. And basically the contest was Geordi kind of says, well, could you really be as smart as Holmes? And so he accidentally phrases it such that Moriarty has to be able to defeat Data, which means, of course, he has to be conscious and actually affect the Starship. So
I just have to say it's all Dr. Pulaski's fault. I just have to geek out
really?
And say, oh my God.
Because what'd she do?
I hated her because she was racist against Data. So Data is an artificial life form, and the Doctor kept making all these snide, not very veiled comments about how he's not real. He can't, really be self-aware and blah 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 blah. And so she puts him up to the task. She says, "Here, if you go into the simulation of Sherlock Holmes, can you actually, can you solve a puzzle that Holmes has never solved?" And so that's
you
why
just
they...
didn't like Pulaski because of Crusher was gone, right?
Beverly
had to leave.
Crusher was okay. I actually didn't love Crusher. I didn't dislike Dr. Crusher. But Dr. Pulaski was just mean.
In any case, I won't ruin the entire show, the episode, because I think you should go see the episode, episode 138. It's called Ship in a Bottle of Next Generation.
There's another one later on with him as
that's
well.
True. That's true. But in any case, it's kind of like this Tamagotchi problem where you make a virtual world and perpetually run it. So the Tamagotchi, which of course aren't really sentient, but
right.
theoretically Moriarty yeah. is sentient in the Star Trek universe. Shall we move on?
No, I have to say one more thing. Speaking of, because you brought Star Trek
sure.
up, I have an app idea. And because app ideas are worth about 25 cents until you actually implement them, I'm just going to share it right now.
You know about my blog, right?
You have, what's that?
Spare Ideas.
You have a blog called Spare Ideas?
Yeah, I'll link to it from the Geekspeak site. Basically, anytime I have an idea that I'm not going to implement, but I think it's maybe worth 25 cents if someone were to implement it, I go ahead and put it up on this blog of example sites. So maybe I'll add yours.
You give them away for free. Uh-huh. I've actually started building this, but I don't know. We'll see if I have enough time.
What is it?
It's called, currently, Star Trek Me. Now, I haven't Googled to see if this exists or not.
What does it do?
Have you ever had the circumstance where someone says, hey, do you want to watch Star Trek? Mm-hmm. And you say, oh my gosh, yes. What episode should we watch?
Have I ever had that? I have that every day.
All right. So how do you decide what episode to watch?
Oh. I think it normally came about because of a conversation. So I, for example, would watch both these episodes of Moriarty.
Yeah. So I'm just much more of a Star Trek fan than you are, because I don't need to be thinking of an episode.
So
I just,
what does your app do?
I just have a constant need for Star Trek. So my idea is there are so many Star Trek episodes that really, really suck. They're horrible. They're awful. And I don't want to watch those. And even more so, I don't want to put any of my friends through that. And so right now my selection process is I select a somewhat random episode. I look it up online and I read the entire plot synopsis. And then I figure out, oh, that's the one that's bad. And I do it again and again and again until I find one that I haven't seen recently and all the blah, blah, blah. The app idea, Star Trek Me, will take all of these crowdsourced ratings, which exist on IMDb.
Sure.
And it'll say, yeah, click this button and you'll get a random Star Trek episode that's in the top 70%.
Great.
Or in the top 50% or whatever.
Yeah.
Or there'll also be an I'm feeling unlucky button, which will give you one of the worst episodes.
Will this be a TNG restricted app?
Oh no.
You could fill it from the entire universe.
All anything.
Right. Awesome.
Deep Space Nine is probably the one that I'm running from the most. Some of the earlier episodes are just ghastly.
I'm Lyle Troxell. I'm speaking with Ben Jaffe. We're chatting about Star Trek and other geeky things here on KOSP. Do stay with us, won't you? You're listening to Geekspeak on Independent Public Radio KOSP. I'm Lyle Troxell, and with me is Mr. Ben Jaffe. Hey, Ben.
Hey.
How was your Black Friday?
My Black Friday? It was...
As in the day after Thanksgiving, the day consumers consume.
I can't get behind it, because Thursday, the day before, is the day that we're all supposed to come together and talk about what we're thankful for that we have. And then the very next day, we go out and buy as much stuff as possible, as much new stuff as possible. So that's a little upsetting to me.
Absolutely. You know, my Black Friday, I bought one thing, and that was I bought a part to a broken lamp, and then I went and fixed the lamp. And the lamp was, I would say, about 60 years old. And all it needed was a new switch, basically. And it had been fixed before. In fact, it had a dimmer switch. But the thing that was I felt good about was that I wasn't actually just throwing something away. I was actually engaging in a repair. And I thought, that is a great thing. Every Black Friday, I'm going to make sure to fix something that could be thrown away because it doesn't work, and instead make something that was broken work again.
Fixer Friday.
Yes, Black Fixer Friday.
I like it.
Preferably, actually, to buy a part you need, because that's kind of cool.
It gets dark earlier, so
that's true.
You know, fix things in the dark. I went out and I bought some PVC and some PVC. What are those called? The things that join the PVC joints, or
sure,
I don't know. I'm not a plumber.
What?
I'll just put that right out there.
Can you describe it with using a vocabulary of less than 1,000 words? What were you fixing in your house that was plumbed needed?
Well, I wasn't exactly. Well, I guess I was fixing something. So I had jury-rigged.
Jury-rigged? Go on. I'll look it up.
So I had put together an outdoor shower, and there were a couple reasons for this. First of all, I was in Bali several years ago, and there was an outdoor shower in the place I was staying, and it was amazing. It's just, it's incredible to shower outside. And
was that the outside, or was that the being in Bali?
Both.
Okay.
It was both.
Okay.
I mean, it was kind of nice because it was warm and humid, so you didn't get cold showering outside. Also, there was a typhoon at one point, and so I was showering in the hot shower water with the warm typhoon coming out. It was just an incredible experience. So I decided, since I can't go to Bali all the time, I'm just going to try and replicate this as much as possible. The other reason is we're in a drought. And so I built an outdoor shower that's a couple feet off the ground, and the water falls through this platform and gets collected in this basin. And then it gets pumped up to a little water tower that I built. And then we use that water to water our garden.
And this is necessary because you don't own your home, so you can't actually modify your home to actually have a switch off for your shower to go in a gray water reclamation
that's
system.
That's true. I can't.
So instead, you just lift the shower up and...
I can't do it the legitimate way.
Hey, it's jerry-rigged, J-E-R-R-Y.
Named rigged. After Jerry...
I don't know.
Okay. I don't know. You'll get back to me about that.
Well, I don't know. I'm not going to look up who it was named after, but it's not Jury, it's Jerry.
I've learned something today.
There you go.
So what I fixed today is... what I fixed on Black Friday is... previously, I had a hose running from our water supply, our hot water supply, out to the shower.
Mm.
But it's got however many pounds of pressure, you know, that comes out of the wall. And that's not so great for a hose, which is not built for that.
More
and so
importantly
it was,
than that, hoses, garden hoses, are not built for hot water. That's probably why you started
seeing
the fail
system.
It was
a hot water hose.
Oh, that's good.
But it did start to kind of swell irregularly, yeah, sure. And that made me a little nervous because water damage is pretty bad.
Mm-hmm.
So I bought some PVC, and I replaced it with PVC and just kind of ran it up in right angles. And
polyvinyl chloride. You didn't burn it, did you?
No, I didn't.
It's nasty stuff if you burn it.
I certainly didn't burn it. Why would I burn it?
I just, you know, I did a lot of helping people deal with laser cutters, and people always wanted to cut vinyl.
Oh, no.
With laser cutters, and then you make really horrible gas. But in any case, did you glue the whole thing or
screw
the whole thing?
I did. I glued the whole thing, but actually the parts I'm most worried about are the little flexi ends that connect it to the actual wall itself, because I couldn't make it come directly out into the hard PVC.
Right. So you did a hose attachment.
Right. So this is the difficult part for me is sometimes it's really fun to DIY, to do it yourself, right?
Sure.
When it comes to computers, if a computer fails because of something you did, you're probably not going to fry your circuit board. Maybe you just bought the wrong kind of RAM. It just won't work, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then no harm done. You take out the RAM, you put in the old RAM, and you're done.
And that night you still have food and you can still sleep somewhere.
Yeah, right? That's true.
It's not a catastrophe.
Plumbing, though, is a completely different creature, because if that fails and you happen to have just gone out for a cup of coffee or, say, a vacation, that's really bad news. And recently, I had a friend who recently had to deal with this, their house getting flooded.
Sure.
So
you were lucky in your situation, though, because you were tapping hot water that was already out of the house?
It was inside the house and it goes out through the window.
So you could theoretically have a failure that would affect your home.
Right. And so now I'm kind of grappling with the question of, like, is this the kind of thing that I should hire someone to do? Even though I love the idea of just doing everything myself, I really love the idea that I can do it and learn it.
You shouldn't hire somebody to do yourself, because then you'll get an expert who will have knowledge that you can obtain pretty quickly.
Mm.
Now, I'm not saying that there's a giant vast of knowledge around plumbing, but a couple things. Are you using PVC that's rated for hot water?
That's a good question.
Are you? Yeah. See,
is part of the reason I'm having this conversation with you right now is that you know more about this than
I never run hot water through PVC personally. Mm. I don't even know if it's something you should do. I always go with copper when I'm doing plumbing.
Copper requires fire, right?
Copper requires a soldering torch and kit. And your friend Lyle has those things.
Oh, really?
In abundance, yes.
Ooh, do you want to? Hey, you want to come over for dinner?
I could teach you how to do some copper.
That'd
copper
be cool.
Work in your home. It'd be fun.
That'd be cool.
Any case, so what you're saying is, do it yourself is good until you get to a place where maybe I'm doing something dangerous.
It's the risk. Yeah. If the risk is high, then so like it's I guess it's always interesting to negotiate what that line is. Some people are more risk adverse. Some people are...
I feel like if you did enough research and also understood that the reason why things are done a certain way is almost always because that's a safe way to do them.
Right. Yeah.
Right. Like the reason you don't normally see a water line in your home have a hose on it and then connect to a water line again is there's a problem with that, which you just did. So you kind of know there's a problem. You already knew that. I would say, though, this knowledge is not something that would be drastic. You could probably spend a couple hours one night watching YouTube videos and know enough to do exactly what you want to do safely. And I recommend doing that, Ben, before you melt your house down.
Well, just for the record, I'm turning it off at the source every time. After.
Right.
Just because, you know,
I figured,
like,
you're basically taking a shower by turning on the sink source inside the home. You go outside, you turn on the shower, you take a shower.
Take a shower.
You stop, you turn off both of them. So it's not very risky.
It's not very... No, it's not actually risky, but it would be nice to not have to do that extra step. It'd be also nice to know that I did something a good way, you know?
Ben, are we really talking about your shower protocol on GeekSpeak?
Why not? It's... I mean, I'm a geek about it. It's kind of fun.
Well, since we're talking about fixing...
Yes.
Ben, tell me about iFixit and the right to repair.
So first of all, do you know about iFixit?
I love iFixit.
Yeah.
Can I describe it?
Please.
iFixit's a website and service that sells parts and instructions, gives away instructions on how to repair your smart devices. So your tablets and your phones, which are extremely complicated, normally require special tools. They have video breakdowns and description breakdowns and all the parts necessary to do that. So next time you break your smartphone screen, you could theoretically go up onto iFixit, download the PDF that describes how to fix it yourself, buy necessary parts from them, and do the repair yourself.
Yeah.
Now, that being said... I've decided in my life it's time to stop opening small electronics myself.
Well, yeah, small electronics.
Man, they are hard to deal with. Laptops still, I mean, even the MacBook Pros and stuff, last time I opened one, I didn't really close it the right amount.
I have had better luck with MacBook Pros, with even the recent ones. But it's kind of an interesting question, you know, because like, on the one hand, so as the article says, normally if I purchase a hammer, if the head of the hammer falls off, I'm allowed to repair it, right?
Of course.
Not only allowed to repair it, but I can repair it. So usually if you buy a hammer and the head of the hammer is attached to the handle using some kind of mechanism or a screw or something like that, it's just a normal screw.
Ben, you don't screw a hammer head onto a hammer body. That's not how you do it.
Well, okay,
you gotta
not
do
a
with
screw,
pressure.
But there are things that do stuff, and the stuff and the things make the thing happen. And if the thing doesn't happen, then you can thing the thing and make it better.
So you have an old sledgehammer,
so
and
clearly,
the handle's broken.
Clearly,
you can actually buy a new handle and attach it, and no one's going to fault you for fixing your hammer.
Yes, and please don't fault me for not knowing all of it.
That's because you've never fixed the hammer.
I've never fixed the hammer before, no. So have you heard of the pentalobe screw?
These are these screws that are hard to undo?
Yeah, they're these five-sided screws that Apple is using.
Yeah.
And just to be clear, it's not just Apple, right?
No, there's security screws. There's a whole bunch. There's Torx was one of the first ones. And then there was security. Actually, Philips started this way as well, as a screw that was harder to open without the right tool. And all of the tool head designs are patented. So theoretically, you can't make a tool that undoes the screw and sell that tool without paying a royalty, which Apple won't provide to you, or whatever company. So there's consortiums. These are very useful for securing stuff in public bathrooms and stuff. You'll notice that screw heads in public bathrooms are weird.
You can only screw them one way.
Sometimes they're one way. Sometimes they're these Torx with a pin in the center, all around the idea that you're not supposed to get into it yourself. You're supposed to have an expert do it.
Right. But you can go and buy Torx screwdrivers, right?
Yes.
So why not use Torx screwdrivers? It's the kind of screwdriver that only someone who kind of knows what they're doing or has at least taken the initiative to buy the kind of screwdriver that they need, that kind of comes with, like, they know that they're taking some kind of risk by opening this thing, and they're willing to accept that risk, right? You don't have, you know, Torx screwdrivers laying around.
What's the one you're talking about?
Pentalobe. It's a different screw that is five-sided, and it kind of looks like a what are those clover things? It's one of the... how to explain this? You know how you have the four suits in a deck of cards?
Yeah.
It's like the clover. That's the word. It's like the club, but it's five-sided without the stick coming out the bottom.
So it's rounded size?
Man, I'm having fun with words today.
Rounded stars?
It's like rounded.
Okay.
It's like a rounded star.
Does it also
star.
Have a pen in the center?
It does not.
All right.
But yeah, it seems to only exist to prevent people from opening up their devices, right?
Pentalober.
Actually, it might be on the bottom of your iPhone if you have an iPhone just before they switch to the new plug.
Mm-hmm.
The idea behind that is that they're specifically doing things to keep people from opening them, right? Apple
is making their product so it's harder for them to people to open them. Why are they doing that?
I mean, presumably because they don't want people opening them. They don't want people opening them and replacing the batteries. They don't want people opening them and replacing the screens. Presumably, or at least some would say that it's because companies like iFixit cut into their profits. They also disrupt the consumer relationship as well.
I will argue the counter that it's possible that they don't want people to get into above their head. And if you're a repair shop that knows how to do this, you simply buy this $5 tool and then it's no problem. So, I mean, that's a possibility that it really is about making sure the barrier to entry is high enough to only let people that really should do this do it. At the same time, that should and that qualifier there is a little frustrating. Though at the same time, I know it's not that hard with the internet being the way it is to buy one of these screwdrivers.
For a little while it was because it was a new screw.
Right. For a while it was hard.
Tiny Phillips head screwdrivers, you need to go and buy special ones. They're like size 0 and 00.
Well, you can use
tiny,
a knife.
You could use, well, a very sharp knife, yes.
Yeah.
You'd ruin the knife.
Yeah.
There's also the Torx. There's also the security Torx.
Okay, so
why not use any of those?
Okay, so you don't want to use a Phillips because a Phillips doesn't, the head of the Phillips will release a screw too easily, so it's hard to have a machine head grab that piece.
Okay, so I buy that argument.
I'm totally making this up, by the way. I don't really know. but yeah, I agree that the popularity of all these crazy heads, and by the way, we'll have some pictures up on geekspeak.org if you want to know the kind of head type, screw head types and what they're called and such. So iFixit is saying stop it, right?
iFixit is saying stop it. And they're also saying the Pentalope screw is an example. They made the first screwdriver in the world outside of Apple that would remove that screw. Apple didn't give anyone a clear heads up, here's the spec sheet or whatever. So I don't know. That's not so great. Another argument that they're making is environmentally it's horrible.
How so?
Because a lot of times if you send your phone back to Apple rather than repairing it, Apple will just e-waste it, right?
Right.
Whereas it might be a phone that you actually could go and replace the battery for, or you could go and replace the screen for, and maybe if it's an older model, Apple can't get a whole bunch of those and then resell them because it's two models ago. So that phone still has a lot of utility, a lot of life left in it, but it's going to get e-wasted because it can't be as easily repaired by people who want to or who choose to.
Do you think this is something we definitely have a responsibility to change in our society such that we're not condemning products to death after a small error?
Absolutely, I think so. I do hear the argument that, you know, operating systems are going to change and the hardware requirements for software to run are going to change, and that's why hardware becomes obsolete and everything. But like, where a phone might have had 5 years in it, now people are pretty, you know, readily accepting a 3-year lifespan or a 2-year lifespan on their smartphones. And that's awful. Also, when you take a look at those phones and you think about the phones that the third world are using, if they could just have those phones that are getting e-wasted, that would be better. That would be a net win. So that's the argument I would make.
All right. I like it.
I don't know. Your thoughts?
Well, I definitely feel like I want to do devil's advocate again a bit, because I think if you get a new phone, a relatively newer model phone that's broken, you take it back to a store and that goes back to the manufacturer, they will recycle that and reuse it in this, and that's what refurbished phones are. So normally, if you're buying a new phone, you should definitely try to find a refurbished one, because it's basically factory reset, new screen, new camera lens, whatever it was.
But if it's 2 years old, things are different.
Additionally, if you break like an iPhone and you bring that screen or the iPhone into an Apple store, the staff there will repair it right there and mm-hmm. give it back to you with the new screen. Mm-hmm. So it's not like they're always just disposing it when one thing breaks.
That's true.
That's just devil's advocate. At the same time, the idea that the complexity of the system is such that it makes more sense most of the time to toss it or to, you know, dispose of that big piece rather than try to repair it, I think that barrier is really challenging. And so that's all I have to say about it. I agree that we should have a right to open and also the knowledge to share about how to fix things. I don't like the idea that though you have a phone on you right now, Ben, some Android device phone, mm-hmm. some of the stuff in there is proprietary. You're not supposed to necessarily know what it is. Apple phones are like this as well. And reverse engineering it doesn't really get you far enough. And basically, you are actually only licensing the operating system. You're not actually owning the operating system. There's a lot of weird rules around it where it's not actually your property, like a hammer that you broke.
Yeah, I didn't actually break my hammer.
Have you made
it? If I had broken a hammer, I would know that it wasn't attached with a screw.
The hammer head attachment is so cool, though, Ben. I've got to describe this to
okay,
you.
Okay, please.
So
if you can describe it on the radio.
All right, you take a stick, and a hammer head basically just has a hole in it. And you take the stick, the handle, and you poke it from the bottom through the hole, and it slides through.
Okay.
Then you take a wedge of some sort, and you jam it into the top of the stick, whereas it's a split. That wedging quality causes it to press against the steel of the head. As you swing the hammer, it tightens that fitting. So it tightens by its own centrifugal use, which is really cool.
That's pretty cool.
The one problem of this is picks. You know, like a big pick, a wood, you know, like you're mining in the ground kind of pick.
Yeah.
A pick like that, when you haven't used it for a long time, the wood handle will shrink a bit because it has no moisture in it. And the pick head, because it falls towards your hands, when you swing it above your head, might fall off onto your hands. It's a very painful experience.
Have you had this happen?
I've had this happen many times.
Oh, no.
And so you, of course, need to tighten down the head enough so that before you start using it. And the way to do that actually is to just bang the stick, the protruding stick part onto the concrete, and the pick head will slam down on, and then it won't do that anymore.
That's really neat. I like it. See, analog solutions like that actually make me much happier than any software solutions. Like these days, we've got these phones in our pockets that have, you know, more than 1 gigahertz of processing power inside each one of them, and a lot of the solutions that we come up with, the software solutions that we come up with, are not particularly efficient. It's just that the machines are so fast that it doesn't really matter. But when you look at analog solutions like that, or the way that stereo is recorded or is encoded in a record player, something like that, like all of those different ways of thinking about it, you're working with much less. And you have to be more, you have to use your ingenuity a little bit more.
Do you think that you and I talk more about audio because we do a podcast and radio show?
Oh, yeah, definitely.
Because we're focusing on that. Because like every week we come to talk to each other and we stick microphones in front of our face and headphones on. And so immediately one of the things I start talking and thinking about is the making of what we're doing.
Yeah.
And as geeks, you know, we invest in and inspect things around us all the time. And so commonly, we're cued before we start talking to talk about audio because that's the thing we're engaged in at that moment. Software as well, of course, because we have laptops in front of us as we record this.
It's a fun meta conversation.
Because you talk, well, exactly. I always, right. Earlier today, we were talking about what we're going to talk about today, and I was thinking about my mic setup, and so I thought, well, we'll talk about mics. But of course, I want to refrain from that because I don't want it just to be about navel gazing, right?
Yeah. I mean, the things that we talk about are often determined by our expertise,
yes,
and also what happens to be right in front of our faces. And right now, I've got a bright pink windscreen on a SM58 in front of my face, and you've got a blue windscreen with a microphone in front of your face.
I don't think it's an SM58 in front of you. You have the pink one? Is the pink one an SM58?
I don't know. Let me...
Here we go, navel gazing.
I've got the real one.
You've got the real one. I've got the fake one.
You've got the fake one. We've got these two. We've got these mics, and some of them are Shure SM58s, and some of them are mics that look exactly the same and as these $100 microphones.
Yeah, the Shure SM58 is like a $100 microphone, and it's a standard. You can drive a nail with these things. They're very durable. In fact, anytime you see a microphone, pretty much anytime you see a microphone, it's
if
an
you
SM58.
Sing a singer on a stage holding a microphone that looks like
a snow cone,
yeah, that's a SM58.
So the one that I'm actually using right now is called a Playa. P-Y-L-E, ply.
It's actually really funny watching you try to look at the backside of the mic while talking into the front side.
It's called a PD Mic 58.
A PD Mic 58.
See, I wonder if they're copying it. It's an exact form factor as an SM58.
And it's the like silk screen of
the
pink, right?
Is the paint is the only reason, no. And it's $10 shipped. Amazing. And it's the thing that changed the way I was doing the mic. It used to be that I was stealing mics from you all the time.
Thanks.
Yeah. And keeping them for long periods of time. And now I went ahead and bought three of these things. So we've got a full kit. And I actually like this mic quite a bit. Moving on, I want to talk with you, Ben, about figuring things out versus knowing things.
Oh, that's a good conversation topic.
I was told at one point to take it when you have to fix a pickaxe to bang it on the ground. I never really understood why. I did it because. And then over time, I get why.
Right.
Because you compress the head of the pick, the wood, into the steel, and that builds a really good, beautiful bind. Doing it any other way is very difficult. If you want to release that thing, you turn it over and you pound it on the ground, hopefully not hurting yourself when the pick head releases.
Uh-huh.
Using gravity and force in a pretty effective way.
Right.
Things were taught to me, and then over time I understood them. Most of the time in my life with software, people don't teach me. I have to learn myself.
Now, you know, this is interesting because for the longest time in my life, I've worked in tech education.
Mm-hmm.
And a huge part of becoming a computer programmer or really any kind of similar job is how do you look things up? How do you Google things? And how do you figure things out and explore in a kind of controlled and relatively productive way? Mm-hmm. Not so much how many things do you know? You know, so like, if you ask me what's the API for arrays, I'll be able to tell you a good amount of it, for example, in JavaScript, because I do it a lot. If you ask me in Python, I'll be like, I don't remember any of it. But you know what? I know how to find out really fast. And mm-hmm. that's really the thing that matters, right?
Yeah. I was, for Thanksgiving weekend, I visited my mother, and she's doing a whole bunch of audio transferring of tapes to some form that's not analog tape.
Yeah, analog to digital.
Yeah. And I showed her that you don't have to go down to the store to do this. In fact, her old iMac actually has the capability of doing this. I just gave her a cable. Setting her up with that one cable and then teaching her how to use GarageBand, which comes with OS X almost all the time anyway, she was able to get audio off of her analog tapes and save them to her iTunes and therefore be able to play them and share them and make new CDs.
Right.
That's what she wanted to do. So after showing her how to do this, the next day she was doing it herself, so she would remember, and I was still there, and she came in and said, Lyle, how do you do this one thing? I can't recall exactly what the step was, but I think it was about setting up the input settings. And I said, I don't know. And she got really kind of upset because, of course, I knew. I did it yesterday, so of course I knew. So I had explained to her, no, actually, I don't know how to do things on computers. I know how to figure out how to do things on computers.
Right.
It's very different.
Right, right.
If you ask me how to do anything on a computer, I would have to have a computer in front of me to do it because I don't memorize the things. In fact, the most crucial skill you could have as being a geek is how to figure things out. And the reason is if you know how to do something in one iTunes version, 4 days later when they update it again, you won't know mm-hmm. how to do it. You have to be able to train yourself all the time on how to figure things out. And it's not just about looking for the right word in the menu. It's about looking at the menu and assessing out what's there so you know the next step.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So if I'm doing tech support for somebody, I'll commonly ask them to click on a menu item and read all the items and then tell them stop.
What's there?
Because I need to have the context where I don't know how to do it.
Try that one. Try that one.
Do you find that's true in education? How do you teach people how to use computers?
Oh, absolutely. It's so hard to get that across.
Mm-hmm.
So when I was working for Udacity, a lot of times we would have students say, hey, you just told me you told me to Google this. I'm not paying you guys to tell me to Google things. Like, that's ridiculous. I want you to tell me how to do it.
Mm-hmm.
But that's exactly the wrong attitude to take, I think. That's at least it's a self-defeating one. It's about, I guess, for educators, it's about trying to get across that understanding of how to figure things out, or that of tools of how to figure things out. Mm-hmm. And it's not about the actual thing that you're doing. I got certified years and years and years ago with Apple Logic 8, which is a digital audio workstation. Uh-huh. Yeah. So the kind of thing that you might mix and master, record and mix and master a top 200 song hit in, right?
Mm-hmm.
And we're on Logic X, I think, something like that. We're several versions ahead, and a lot has changed. Same with Final Cut. I know the older version of Final Cut, and now we're on Final Cut X, and I can do video editing on that just fine, because not because I know where things are, but because I know how to figure things out.
So if you get frustrated by your computer and you feel like you don't know how to do something you used to know how to do, realize that the challenge is teaching yourself how to learn how to do something, which requires right. some interest, unfortunately, in it. Because if you're not interested in it, it does not become a joyous thing to do.
If you're not interested, you're not motivated. If you're not motivated, then, well, you look for your cousin or uncle or whoever knows computers to do
and
it for you.
I think the movement we've seen in user interface design over the last 10 years has been to focus on making it a lot easier to figure it out without instructions.
I love that, actually. I feel like Apple did that very, very well with the iPhone.
Lots of companies have done that.
You pick this thing up and you just figure out how to use it. You're not told how to use it. Remember, software used to come with these
manuals. Yeah.
These manuals. Yeah, and you'd read the manual and you'd think, okay, gosh, I know how to do everything, but I've forgotten most of it.
Right.
So I'll just keep this manual next to me on my desk.
So the other thing I think I do a lot is I try to think like the person that wrote the software.
Mm-hmm.
And that's
it's trick. Easier if you're a programmer.
I think it is.
It's much easier.
That one
if
I can't
programmer.
Really hand off to people. What's your somebody calls you on the phone, asks you for tech support. What do you do? What's your first step, Ben?
I figure out how they got my phone number.
I used to tell them, listen to KUSP on Saturdays at 10. 11,
yeah, call in.
Call in, but we don't do calls anymore. You can email us, though. You can contact us about anything we're talking about up in geekspeak.org, and you can find us on Facebook and Twitter and Google+, and we're KOSP Geeks is how you find us. You're listening to Geekspeak. I'm with Ben Jaffe. I'm Lyle Troxell. We'll be right back. You're listening to Geekspeak. Ben, what's Yahoo done recently with their Yahoo Mail service?
Oh, yeah. That's a fun one. So Yahoo... So we've been having this conversation about ad blockers for the last...
Ad blockers? Like
ad blockers.
Online ad blockers, where you're served ads, but your browser, you have something installed that stops that ad from being shown to you.
Yeah, a Chrome plugin or a Firefox plugin or something that blocks ads. So that way, rather than seeing a whole bunch of ads on all the news websites, on all the different sites, you see no ads.
And a big thing to note about this is these ad systems normally take a lot of resources. They take bandwidth, which means the page gets to you slower, but also it takes processing power for your page to actually load it and run it. Uh-huh. And if you turn these things off, the websites get a lot faster.
Yes.
Which is kind of frustrating.
Yeah, especially if you're on a mobile device, it might be slurping down megabytes and megabytes of stuff, of ads, rather than just downloading the page. And sometimes the ads come in before the content.
Ugh.
That drives me even more
crazy.
So
do you run ad blockers on your
I
system?
Do. Now,
what do you use?
What is it? Adblock Plus? Yeah, Adblock
See, Ben
Plus.
Had to look it up. He didn't know. He had to look it up.
Right. I knew where to look. Actually, I didn't know where to look. I just looked and, oh, there's an ABP with a big stop sign. That's probably it. And it looks like on Slashdot, 10 ads were blocked, at least 10 resources.
Doesn't that mean you're taking money from Slashdot?
All right, so that's the tricky part. So I'll get to this story in just a moment, but of course, ads are the way that that websites monetize the internet, right? Mm-hmm. So if Slashdot serves me an ad, and I look at that ad, and I click on it, maybe I buy something, maybe I don't, that exposure, exposing me, a user, to that ad is worth something.
And that something is normally given to the site you're going to.
Right.
Slashdot, by the way, is News for Nerds. It's this magazine, collaborative magazine service that's been around for a long time for nerds. Lots of times articles we find on Slashdot, mm-hmm. because they're rated up. And then we normally read the source as well, because they're always linked to other source files.
Yeah, but it's kind of an ethical dilemma that we've talked about many, many, many times on this
mm-hmm.
program.
Sure.
If you block the ads, then you are effectively not allowing the page you're on to get money from the ad
right.
people, right?
Right?
And that's exactly the way sites like Slashdot cover the costs, mm-hmm. right? It doesn't cost all that much to run a website, but when you have millions of visitors every week, well, you know, you need to fund that somehow, and showing and a bunch of people ads is sure. a really great way to do it.
Okay.
So Yahoo is actually running an A/B test right now, which blocks access to Yahoo email if Yahoo detects that you're using an ad blocker.
Just a second. A/B test. It's a very common methodology for software engineers to understand. The basic idea is you have a whole bunch of people using your service, like Yahoo Mail, and you give half the people one experience, and you have half the people the other experience, test A, test B, and then you look at the metrics of both the users, and if one experience means that people stop using the service, you know that that's the wrong one to choose. And so you do all your development that way with A-B tests, and over time, your service gets better and better and better.
How do you know about A-B tests?
Netflix runs a lot of A-B tests.
You work at Netflix, exactly. We do. Yeah. So if you're going to a site like Netflix or like Yahoo or any of the big companies that do a lot of A/B tests, you're probably in at least one test,
right?
Where you're in a bucket of people and you're interacting in your normal way, and then other buckets of people are interacting with a different experience in their different way. So Yahoo is running this A/B test, and one of the groups gets blocked, like they can't access their Yahoo email if Yahoo detects that you're using an ad blocker. Basically, Yahoo says you can't get your email until you turn off that ad blocker.
Do they give a notification to the user that the email is not available because of ad blocking?
I don't have Yahoo Mail.
Okay.
Well, the message does say, please disable ad blocker to continue good. Using Yahoo Mail.
Right. So this makes a lot of sense, right? Yahoo's making money off of their off the ad revenue mm-hmm. on their mail service, and then giving the mail service in trade for you looking at those ads. That's mm-hmm. kind of the contract you're doing. So what they're basically doing is enforcing that, saying, look, you can keep using this free service, but you got to start looking at the ads.
Right.
And I don't think there's anything wrong in Yahoo doing that.
I don't either, but I think it's a little bit more complicated than that.
Okay.
And here's why. So first, let's talk about what other sites doing. Hmm. So if I go to abc.com or whatever, some news site, I can't remember which one it is, whenever I go there, it says, hey, it looks like you're using an ad blocker. Just so you know, that negatively impacts us in this way.
Uh-huh.
You know, consider disabling it.
Have you ever disabled it?
No.
Why?
Because it takes work to disable it. Don't make me do stuff. I just want to read this free content, right? I mean, we're all quite entitled.
Yeah, but you're a very decent fellow who would definitely, if you, you know, had a piece of art from a friend, you'd probably compensate them for it. Like, you're not
right.
opposed to giving money for value. Like, that's not...
Or if I sit in a coffee shop and I drink my latte and I sit there for 4 hours... and I just drink one latte, I'm going to give a really big tip, because otherwise I'm going to feel like a jerk.
Right.
When I see that message, I feel a little pang of guilt. So I think like, God, oh man.
Well, there's a software problem with your ad blocker. Your ad blocker should just have a whitelist button.
Oh, it does.
Oh, well, push the button, Ben.
Well, I've never whitelisted a site before, so now I have to go and figure out
how to whitelist.
Let me see. How do we...
Oh, Ben's
it's
figuring
actually,
this thing out. It's extremely...
It's really easy. It's extremely easy. But the point is, I don't do it because I feel a little bit of guilt. I am met with no negative repercussions other than that pang of guilt.
Mm.
And the pang of guilt is not enough to compel me to act. Now,
also, it's opposite, right? Like, it's not that you are saying to the site that you want to read the story, I'm going to block these ads. You made the decision a while ago, and now you're just there.
Exactly. So let me just make the case so I can feel less guilty right now.
Good luck.
I don't believe I am the kind of person. Now, this is going to be a little bit of a catch 22 here, or double think or something, right? I don't feel that I'm the kind of person who goes and gets content for free and blocks the ads to prevent the company from making money.
But you just, but that's exactly what you're doing, isn't it?
That's what I'm doing. But I'm not the kind of person who would do that.
Can I phrase that you don't think you're the kind of person that does that? Because I think you are.
No, I said I don't feel like I'm that kind. Let me tell you how this makes sense in my head. I'm not defending this. I'm just saying it makes some kind of sense in my head.
We acknowledge that we're irrational.
I made one choice once to install AdBlock Plus.
Mm.
I installed AdBlock Plus. Suddenly the internet was faster. There were no ads. I made that decision one time. I don't get to remake that decision. If I went to that website and it said, hey, it looks like you're using an ad blocker, consider disabling it. If instead the ad blocker popped up before I visited the page and said, hey, do you want me to wipe away all the ads? And I had to say yes every single time, I would feel like a jerk because I'd be actively making a decision to take away money from all of these individual companies one by one. Right. As opposed to, I've just set up my browser in such a way that I just don't get ads and I don't have to make that choice anymore. Right. Mm-hmm. So if I had to make that choice every single time, I would not block ads. But because we have Chrome and Firefox extensions that you just set them and forget them, I've pretty much forgotten what it's like to have to be served ads all the time.
Well, wouldn't it be nice if your ad blocker surfaced a little button about 10 seconds after you were on the site saying, You haven't loaded ads for the site, and you're reading the site. Like, it makes sense to me to kind of prompt and then you could just hit a command key. You love command keys, and then boom, the ads would load.
Yeah, and I'd be totally for that. Of course, AdBlock Plus doesn't have all that much incentive to add that, but if that existed, I think I would hit the button to enable the ads on some things because I would feel like I was giving something to that to those pages. We're kind of in this weird space and we don't really have a solution yet.
That's true.
There are people trying to say like, hey, buy the premium experience, pay us, $1 a month and then you don't get ads. Right. But
I personally like that one quite a bit.
I like it a lot, but I don't think it's going to work because people already don't have ads. So it's interesting. I'm very interested to see where this will go.
GeekSpeak is a registered service mark of David Lawrence and is used with permission. And GeekSpeak is Creative Commons Attribution 3.0. Reuse our stuff any way you'd like. You can even make money on it. Just let them know the geeks say hi. This is Independent Public Radio 88.9 KUSP Santa Cruz and streaming live worldwide at KUSP.org. To find out more about this or any episode of GeekSpeak, please visit geekspeak.org. I'm Lyle Trox with Ben Jaffe. GeekSpeak is produced by myself. Thanks to our intern, Chandler, and our Canadian correspondent, Greg Merkley. And thank you for being here for the December 12th, 2015 episode of GeekSpeak.